opens wide for Wade. What a dunk! Fournier blocked his dunk.
Here's Wade against Green. Euro step. Basket.
Welcome to the Heat Check. I'm Wes Goldberg. With me, as always, it's David Ramil. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. Trying to stay dry here in Florida.
Is it raining?
Constantly.
Is it like, oh, you have the tropical storm. Is it? What's the new path for the hurricane?
Oh, I have no idea. I stopped checking at the beginning of the week. When I knew it wasn't going to hit us, I basically just went ahead and take it easy and realized that I had nothing to worry about. But I think that's an attitude a lot of Floridians have in general.
Yeah, I mean, I found that, like, when the hurricane hits, you just sit inside and drink the whole time. And then once you realize that the hurricane's not coming you to celebrate, you just sit around and drink.
That's basically it. You've got it nailed.
Yep. So, speaking of sitting around and drinking, we had a good idea about taking Zach Lowe's recent Grantland piece and really just going onto the podcast and dissecting that thing. There's a lot of information. If you haven't read it, it's up on Grantland, obviously. It's Zach Lowe's, I believe, most recent article. And it basically has to do with the Heat being the most intriguing team in the NBA this season. And we're happy to hear that. But he brings up a lot of interesting points, some good, some bad. And we're just going to get into it and just really go bit by bit and dissect this thing.
We also should point out the name of the post is the Heat Check.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think we should start charging royalties to Grantland. They, you know, they can afford to pay off Bill Simmons. I think they can afford to cut us a little check here and there.
We really should. When I saw that, actually, I saw it on my timeline. I was like, who stole our name? Oh, it was Zach Lowe. Okay. But, yeah, so the title was, the Heat Check was in the title. So, obviously, we need to collect on royalties. And then he also used Spursian in that piece, which I believe was my thing that I made up.
Oh, absolutely. I remember prior to last season, you came up with that term all on your own, and it took off like wildfire, I think.
Yeah, I think we really got something there, and he used Spursian as well. So he used two of the things that happened here.
So clearly
he's a fan. We'll take credit for the post, and now we're going to just take the entire post and base an entire podcast around it, so...
Tit for tat, so to speak.
Yeah, and as everybody knows, we make tons of money on every episode of this, so I guess it all evens out.
Wait a minute.
Oh, I make tons of money. Have you not been getting the checks in the mail?
Have you been putting the wrong address accidentally?
By the way, address I just used my, air quotes bank there. Account. Direct deposit address.
Oh, nice.
All right, so let's just get into this thing. You start... I really like how you you emailed me earlier, and you mentioned about how he starts the article and your feelings about how he just starts the article. It was pretty interesting.
It is. It's a pretty loaded line. I can't go so far as to call it a lead, but the piece kicks off with, "If they weren't the Miami Heat, we'd all be laughing at them." And he goes on to break down that basically a variation of that line has been uttered by a number of rival executives in the NBA. And his point is basically that the system that Miami has used most recently to build the team that they currently have is far from a typical one. And so, you know, you look at the way they've overpaid perhaps for guys like, you know, Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade, especially at this point of his career. The fact that you've got an aging Luol Deng on the roster, an unknown factor in Hassan Whiteside, and that you traded away a number of future first-round picks for a guy like Goran Dragic, who may not work out perfectly because he has a history of back issues, health issues. And so you look at that overall composition of this team, and immediately Lowe kind of casts it in a negative light. But he does kind of hedge that a little bit by saying, you know, Miami's done this and it looks on paper to be a very good team, but you can't get away from the fact that there's a little bit of a negative shadow cast over the whole attitude about the piece, about the Heat in general. Although he does say later on that this could be a better version of the Lakers, and mm-hmm. by, you know, By referring to that, he's saying how this past season they kind of whiffed on a number of free agents there, despite the fact that they had Kobe on the roster, despite the fact that they're optimistic about their future. They had all this salary cap space, and they weren't able to lure a big-name free agent there to play along Kobe in the twilight of his career. So it was a very interesting start to a piece.
It was, and I want to just kind of talk about – we have a few things we want to get to, like are they the Lakers? What's this team's ceiling? And some of the flaws with this roster that we might be that we could see this season. But really quick, I want to backtrack a little bit, and I feel like everybody thinks like this whole big three thing really started. Like, yeah, it was the greatest haul ever of free agency. It was this huge thing. We get it, but this is not something that was just new to Riley, right? Pat Riley's done this ever since he's been with the Heat. Now it's been 20 years and a day that he's been either the coach or the executive of the Heat. And we go all the way back to even the Alonzo morning, the trade to get Alonzo, the signing of Lamar Odom years after that. But we really go to that Shaquille O'Neal trade when they were able to take Odom, their first-round pick, Ron Butler, and several other players and draft picks and trade that for Shaquille O'Neal. And it was kind of the same thing as Goran Dragic, right? It's just this guy who was on this team. Nobody thought he was going to leave. Next thing you know, he's unhappy and he wants out, and they jumped on it, and they traded what they needed to trade. The guy that they just signed, who was an all-star, Lamar Odom, their lottery pick, Ron Butler, two future first-round picks. They were able to trade those guys real assets and get Shaquille, and they ended up winning a championship and being very competitive for multiple years and coming away with one championship. Then we move on after that, and he gets he plans for this big three summer, gets what he wanted, and that results in more championships. So it's worked in the past, you know, and it arguably should have worked with the Alonzo Mourning thing if you know, but there was a lot of things in that way, and, you know, those are the breaks of the game, right?
Absolutely.
But
I actually wrote about it yesterday because of the whole 20th anniversary there. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you and I had talked about it at one point, the big three that wasn't, where he actually signed Gary Payton or he had come to terms with Gary Payton and Juwan Howard, and then mm-hmm. Payton wound up taking a more lucrative deal to stay in Seattle at that point. This was in 1996. He already had Mourning basically agreeing to a contract. Then Payton kind of left, and then the NBA rescinded his deal with Juwan Howard, and then, you know, he kind of moved on to Plan B, where he re-signed Tim Hardaway and PJ Brown, and, you know, the rest mm-hmm. is history as far as the Heat franchise is concerned. But yeah, the history of the big three runs pretty deep when it comes to Miami and Pat Riley, so it's something to always take into consideration.
And it's his model, right? Like we could say with assuredness that that's his model. He looks for three stars to build around, and then he'll fill it out in any way he can, whether it's minimum contracts, getting guys who are ring chasing like Ray Allen, or conducting the biggest trade ever in NBA history just to get guys like James Posey onto the court with Shaq and Wade. It's just that's his model, and so when Zach Lowe says something like if it wasn't the Heat, everybody would be rolling their eyes. It sounds like a negative, but at the same time, it also hints at that history that we're talking about right now, that if it were the Lakers or this other team that's not their proven model of doing things, you know, it hasn't been, even though the Lakers try it, but they just don't succeed at it, but the Heat continually do it, and they keep succeeding at it to the tune of two different, championships in two different eras of big, of all-star type teams where they do something like this, where they just, you know, swing for the fences. So I kind of got that sense of it from his lead and just kind of where he went with the story. And it's interesting when we take a look at it. But let's talk about that, about Pat Riley taking chances. I mean, he's always swinging for the fences. You know, you and I have talked about this in a long time. I think it's almost fashionable to want to draft, you know, to be the Oklahoma City Thunder or the Spurs and just draft everybody in-house or sign the non-star and just develop him Damari Carroll style like the Hawks are doing or had done. But that's just not what the Heat do, and it wouldn't take advantage of their location in Miami, the all-star power that they have to attract free agents. You know, if you're a good organization, you use what is in your advantages. I mean, if it's a good draft personnel, if it's good scouting services, if it's just your location and the fact that you don't have income taxes to worry about, like, you just use what's at your disposal to build the best team you possibly can. That's what the Heat have been doing, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's come to the realization that the only real draft picks that are of any major value only come as a result of having lost a significant number of games. And so you don't want to get a lottery pick where it's going to be a productive player, a game changer, so to speak, because the end result is that you had to have lost a certain number of games, probably a high amount of games, in order to get to that point in the first place. Sure, he looks back at 2003 and says, yeah, it was great to have Dwayne Wade fall into our laps with a number five pick in that draft, but it took 2 years of being out of the playoffs, the misery of Alonzo Mourning's, you know, kidney disease, you know, a number of different factors here and there that kind of tore apart that team he had assembled with a title in mind. And he's also never really had a lot of faith. This is when he was a coach. He's not the same person anymore as an executive, I think, but he never had a lot of faith in playing rookies as a coach. They were always going to be confined to the bench. He was never going to really give them a lot of playing time. And that was why in 2003 he made that move to kind of step down and give Stan Van Gundy a chance, somebody who was going to be able to be more keen on developing young players. You had an unproven Lamar Odom. You had an unproven Caron Butler. You had Dwayne Wade. You didn't know where he was going to fit in the lineup. And so Riley wasn't the right person to coach that version of the team. And so he turned the reins over to Van Gundy, and it worked out really well. It was one of the best seasons in recent Heat history. So, although not that recently, I guess 12 years ago now. But a lot of fans look back at that kind of unexpected playoff run towards the end of the season and all the success that team had. It was a lot of fun to watch, and it was certainly indicative of Riley's modus operandi moving forward.
And just keeping, like going down the line of what Lowe says, he kind of, you know, Riley comes from that Lakers organization. He brought that kind of superstar mentality into Miami, and he kind of mentioned, Lowe mentions that the Heat kind of are doing what the Lakers are doing, but just alluded to the fact that maybe the Heat just have better luck. Do you think it's luck? Do you think it's maybe it's not luck, but this is kind of the two ways that this can either break for you. Either you're the Lakers and you just invest so much and get nothing in return, like they did with Steve Nash and Dwight Howard, and it just didn't work out. Or you could be the Heat and where it just does work out, you know, and you just are able to ride that wave of momentum and sign more free agents and get people to come to you for even cheaper. What do you make of that?
It's an interesting comparison, because I guess you could look to, you know, just last season where, you know, Riley put a lot of eggs in the LeBron James basket and it didn't always work out. He thought this was going to be, you know, he challenged them at the end of the 13-14 season after losing in the finals to the Spurs. He challenged LeBron specifically saying that you don't leave, and he did. And so, you know, no need to rehash that, but he kind of, you know, he suffered a loss there. And to his credit, he was able to rebuild somewhat by getting a guy like Luol Deng, re-signing Chris Bosh, re-signing Dwayne Wade, etc. It didn't work out last season because of the injuries, but I don't know that it's luck necessarily. I think he always has a plan B, and I guess he's very self-assured, and I think that comes across in meeting with players. Being a former player himself, a guy who's played in championship teams, who's coached championship teams, who's assembled championship teams, you kind of have to, you know, take what Riley says at face value. And I think a lot of players are in awe of them. I think there's a kind of presence there when it comes to with Pat Riley that really appeals to players. And maybe what separates the championship seasons in Miami from those in the Lakers, certainly they have a history of it, is that now this franchise is much more stable than the Lakers one is. Even though they've had, you know, basically ownership there with the Buss family kind of handed down from Dr. Buss to his son, and Jeannie Buss has been there for a long time, and Mitch Kupchak has been there for a long time, they've lost that championship culture, and maybe that's as a result of losing Phil Jackson and Miami. Since Eric Spoelstra kind of took over for Pat Riley, he's kind of maintained that whole culture. I think that really appeals to players. I know that a lot of Heat fans and even some media types kind of overstated, but you can't dismiss it, though. You can't discount it completely, because it seems to really appeal to players. You know, LeBron talked about it. The way he changed his lexicon in dealing with the media, talking about the process. And then he hinted at it when he left Miami, that he was going to take over that kind of mentality, that the attitude that it starts at the top, but it works its way down to the bottom levels of the organization. No matter where you are in that front office or as part of the team, you have to adopt a winning mentality. And I think that's something that really appeals to players when it comes to free agency. So I don't know how much luck it is. I guess there's probably a little bit, but you kind of also make your own luck. And with in Riley's case, I think he's always been able to capitalize when things fall in his lap.
It's recognizing opportunities, and it's interesting that Lowe in his piece even mentioned, like, once Goran Dragic kind of came available, a lot of other people and became a free agent. He wasn't really sought after in free agency because everybody knew that Riley already had him, right? Like, it was almost a done deal, and that's kind of Riley's thing. And talking about the differences between the Heat and the Lakers, I mean, Pat Riley is the difference. I mean, he might conduct his team like the Lakers conducted themselves for years and years and years, but he's the, like, they have Mitch Kupchak, you're right. They lost Phil Jackson. There's been stability there, but they just don't have the figure that Riley is. And Phil Jackson was that in a lot of ways, and he's just no longer there.
He also points out, Lowe does, as far as the whole, you know, make your own luck kind of thing, that 29 other teams rolled their eyes when Justice Winslow fell into Miami's lap with the 10th pick. That was pretty interesting. And I think, you know, you can almost picture, you know, Bill Simmons kind of, you know, shaking his head at this because, you know, he always claims that Miami was very lucky, et cetera. But, you know, what are you going to do? Riley's not responsible for Michael Jordan being a bad executive. And 8 other teams before the Charlotte Hornets had a chance to take a guy like Justice Winslow. They chose not to. Can you blame Riley for taking a guy like Winslow who was projected to be the 4th pick in the draft? I mean, Orlando wanted to take Kristaps. I'm sorry, they wanted to take Mario Hezonja, and the Knicks wanted to take Kristaps Porzingis. So all those kind of breaks fell in place, and Miami, what are they going to do, not capitalize? I mean,
exactly. And teams get breaks. I mean, just look at the Spurs and how they got Tim Duncan. It's like there are down years, and in the NFL, the Indianapolis Colts lose Peyton Manning. They end up 1 year, they get the best, and it's the best draft prospect at quarterback since Peyton Manning, and they get Andrew Luck. So it's like, you know, there are teams that certainly do have that luck, but it's also timing. It's also, you do make your own luck to a certain extent. I'm not going to say that Riley is responsible for Winslow being there at 10. He didn't necessarily do anything for him to be there at 10. But he didn't trade the pick before the draft, and there was talk about that happening. I mean, you know, there's other things that go in. And either way, he was going to get a good player at 10. It just happened to be Justice Winslow. You know, we were thinking it was going to be Stanley Johnson, and Stanley Johnson ended up going at 8. So it's not like it was Justice Winslow where there was not going to be a rookie there. It would have been somebody. And we would have been just as happy with Stanley Johnson, probably, not knowing that Winslow was an option. So, and the other thing I want to talk about, just the difference between the Lakers and the Heat, is Kobe Bryant. And I wonder if, you know, people dispute whether or not other players want to play with Kobe or not, right? Every time you ask an NBA player, oh, of course I want to play with Kobe, he's an all-time great. But we hear, like, that smoke has been kind of in the air for years now. And if you believe where there's smoke, there's fire, you might have that impression that maybe players don't actually want to play with Kobe, or maybe it's not that they don't want to play with Kobe, but they might prefer to play with other players before they play with Kobe. One of those players being LeBron, one of those players being Dwayne Wade, very unselfish type of players, guys that have won championships on, well, not that Kobe hasn't, but you look at these teams past and with coaches like Eric Spoelstra and executives like Pat Riley, it just might be that collective is probably more appealing to players like Ray Allen and Mike Miller and those guys of the world than it would be to go play in LA with Kobe, where you might not get the ball for 15 minutes that you're on the court.
And even me personally, even beyond that, I think you have to go with the fact that as good a player as Kobe is, he hasn't aged well as far as that. He still thinks that he's in his prime back in 2004, 2005 or so. And he doesn't realize that he's no longer that kind of player, but he still holds everybody, including himself. You have to give him credit for that. He still holds everybody to this incredible, unachievable level of perfection, you know, that he's going to push you and push you and push you. I think that kind of just wears on you as a human being. You know, I know that we're talking about athletes in their physical prime that represent the upper 0.005% of basketball players on the planet. But I don't think that you want to deal with somebody as constantly intense as Bryant all the time. I think that's going to wear on somebody, that he doesn't have any room in his life for anything other than just the pursuit of perfect basketball. And although that appeals to maybe the very best of players at times, they still have to take their days off every once in a while. They still have to let go and relax a little bit. And I don't think Kobe has that off switch. I think maybe that's just a legend of Kobe Bryant, but it doesn't sound that way. You know, from beat reporters and people that have covered the team, that's just continuous from him. They expect that kind of search for perfection to always be there. And I think that kind of, you know, that kind of grates on other players. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, especially when you play the way he plays, where he doesn't, he's a good passer, but I wouldn't call him a willing passer. He passes when he has to. So if you wanted to play perfect basketball, perfect team basketball, but it seems like he's sometimes more involved with individual basketball, like, you know, making sure that his shot stroke is perfect every time or whatever. The point is, like, the Heat don't really have that kind of polarizing figure on the team. Not polarizing to other basketball players. Certainly Wade is polarizing to an extent. LeBron is obviously, or was polarizing when he was with the Heat. But that was more of like a media type of polarizing. I mean, polarizing when it's like, do you want to play with them? Do you not want to play with them? Where I think everybody would always want to play with LeBron, right? Except for like Joakim Noah, probably. Everybody else would want to play with LeBron.
No, I don't even think Noah applies there. I think, I mean, didn't he win that kind of BS award of secret player that everybody would want on their team or something like that? I mean, it's not really much of a secret to have the best player on the planet on your roster. But, yeah, I mean, just because he is so willing a passer, that what Bryant is not, you know, he does create opportunities for everybody else. And you've seen a number of players have very, very good career years by being teammates for LeBron James. And, you know, I mean, he's made careers, and I think even role players have really stood out by being part of them. And he's going to get you to that ultimate goal of winning. You know, even if he doesn't always wind up with a championship, you're going to play better, more winning basketball as a result of having LeBron on your team.
And I think let's just go back to the overall arcing point of the Lakers versus the Heat. Just because the Lakers and the Heat have the same sort of system of team building, it doesn't make it right or wrong. It just sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And so while both organizations will build their team through free agency and through trades and being attractive for star players, the Heat just did it right where the Lakers did it wrong. We look at why the Lakers are where they're at now is because they built their big three around Dwight Howard, Steve Nash, and Kobe Bryant, where the Heat built their big three of most recent around LeBron, Bosh, and Wade. Those were three players that genuinely wanted to play together and we think schemed to play with each other and get somewhere together, where the big three in LA was almost forced. And I don't think that's a bad thing. A lot of times these big threes are forced or just kind of assembled and let's see what happens. But it just wasn't the right players. Steve Nash just barely played for them. They didn't have the right leadership in place to play with for Dwight Howard, and Kobe and Dwight didn't get along, so we go back to that Kobe thing. So maybe that just wasn't the right pairing of players. Maybe Kobe's just not the right player to have in a big three. Maybe Shaq was really like the guy that could get along with Kobe just because he's on that opposite side of the spectrum and he just doesn't care what Kobe thinks, while Dwight Howard might be a little bit more sensitive to that. But without going all into that, we look at what the 76ers are doing and what the Thunder did. The Thunder got to where they got by doing basically what the 76ers done, but the 76ers just haven't done it right, you know? But it's still the same model there. It's not right or wrong. It's just whether you do it right or you do it well or if you don't do it well, if that makes sense. And I feel like there's a negative connotation with what the Heat are doing because the Lakers are trying to do the same thing. It just hasn't worked.
Sure. Yeah, I think it goes back to that argument that people have been saying for years about built versus bought. I think there's no perfect way. I think there's something that appeals to people, kind of like a grassroots type building of the team where you draft a player and you develop them and you watch them grow from their rookie season into an all-star type player or a Hall of Famer in the case of Oklahoma City. I mean, they've got two guys there in Durant and Westbrook that are, you know, likely Hall of Famers and two of the best players in the game, maybe two of the best players of all time. But that could have just as easily gone in the opposite direction. Durant might never have put on any weight. He might not ever have been the kind of player that he turned out to be. Maybe an injury here or there to Westbrook and he's not as active or energetic a player, not as capable of putting up the kind of gaudy numbers that he does. So it's,
what if Portland had drafted Durant? The Thunder would have been with Greg Oden.
Right. I mean, you know, every team has had their ups and downs over the course of their franchise history, and I think just Miami has like we've said, they made their own luck, but they've also capitalized on opportunities when they presented themselves, and you can't fault them for that. I don't think there's any perfect system, but Miami's has proven to work over the 20 years that Riley has been in with the Heat.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with investing in proven players, right? And that's what Riley's doing, where as opposed to investing in the draft and right. selling off proven players for assets to get more draft picks to take an unproven player, right? There's that whole thing where a draft pick is almost more – well, a draft pick is more valuable than a first-round pick. You know what I mean? Like, after that guy's taken, you almost just want the pick because it's more movable. It doesn't have a contract – associated with it. It has promise associated with it.
It's like a buying a car, you know, when it's on the lot, it's worth its full value, but the second you drive it off, it lowers appreciably in value. So I think it's that same kind of feeling to it. It's like you never know what you have, and so there's a mystery involved to it, but then once you take a certain player, you see their weaknesses, you see their strengths, how they fit on a team, and all of a sudden that value becomes lower and lower. So it's an interesting perspective.
And just back onto that luck thing. I mean, we talk about like the Heat just being like the luckiest franchise. Everybody said, "Oh, the Heat are just so lucky that Winslow falls in their lap, LeBron signed there." But LeBron also left, and nobody expected that. That was unlucky. And they were able to bounce back from that in basically a year and a half and put together a really good starting five and a deep bench that looks like and that now a team that people are talking about as a contender. We don't know if that's necessarily true. We'll get to that, but that's also a lot of jumping on opportunities. Using, you know, the system that you have put in place to, you know, re-up and rebuild a team on the fly. That's not luck. That's skill, you know.
Right. And Eric Spoelstra, who was interviewed by Zach Lowe for his piece, you know, he mentions that it's very impressive. I mean, just not as the coach of the team, but as a member of the franchise in general, you know, that it's impressive how well the team managed to bounce back from LeBron's departure. How many teams, I think he said, would be talked about as a potential contender 13 months removed from losing the best player on the planet? You look at what Cleveland went through in the 4 years without LeBron there, and that's when they were gifted a number of number one picks, and they had all the opportunity in the world to capitalize on those, and they weren't able to do anything with it. Even with two great first round picks, you know, they took Anthony Bennett, and it didn't work out. His career might be in jeopardy. Kyrie Irving has had a number of injuries, and although he's a very good player and an all-star, you never know where you're going to get from him. You look at what's going to happen this season where he could potentially miss a lot of time, and you go, maybe franchises aren't always cut out to succeed, and Cleveland seems like it's one of them, you know. But, it's interesting how Spoelstra pointed that out.
And let's keep going. Spo also admitted that this team is not as talented as the Big Three, but he does mention that it's deep and that he thinks that it's something that could be cohesive. I mean, yeah, I think we agree with that. This is not as talented as those Big Three teams.
Right, right. And I think his point was that when you assemble the Big Three, it's not that coaching didn't play as big a part. It played certainly a part, but you didn't have to do as much to kind of – their talents were so overwhelmingly great as individuals, and they worked very well together that it didn't require a lot of fine-tuning versus this team. There needs to be some work here, right? I mean, we look at the players that Dragic and Wade are, the way that they create shots, the way that they initiate the offense. You look at a guy like Luol Deng, who kind of, he kind of has a lot of the same similarities as Wade does, maybe a lot better from the perimeter, but he's a cutter, a slasher, kind of like Wade is. He doesn't, work as well with the ball in his hands, but, if he's moving without it, he's very good at finding open shots and finding space there to get his shot off. And all of a sudden, you've got Hassan Whiteside there. How do you find touches for him? And where do you incorporate a new, bulkier Chris Bosh into this model? You know, there's going to be some coaching involved here that wasn't as necessary in 2010 when the Big Three was first assembled.
And it's going to take a long time. So we talk about watching players grow, and this is going to be watching a team just kind of grow and gel and figure out how to work with each other. I mean, yeah, Dragic has been there. The five players in the starting five have been there for half a season at least, but they haven't played a minute together, this starting five, because Bosh and Dragic have never played together. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, the pieces on paper look great, right? You want all five of these guys could be all-stars. But there are things that we worry about, like is Dragic and Wade a functional backcourt on defense? Is Dragic and Wade and Deng functional on offense for the lack of spacing, that because Dragic is a decent three-point shooter, but he likes to get into the lane. Wade ignores that the three-point arc even exists. And Dang, while serviceable, isn't necessarily a 1 3-point threat that's going to be able to space the floor completely for others. He's not a Kyle Korver or a Danny Green or a Ray Allen who can just kind of space the floor for everybody. He's not singularly that great. But so I wonder about that. And then you wonder on the front court side, Bosch, if he's going to want to get near the rim more. Whiteside, who's basically only going to function near the rim. You worry about clogging the lane in that respect. So there's going to be a lot of different pieces. And, of course, Wade and Dragic who want to get to the rim. So, yeah, I mean, like you said, there's going to be a lot of fine-tuning, ways to make sure that these guys are moving on a string, like Spo likes to say, but on offense, that these guys are never too close together, that everybody's seeing what everybody else is doing on the court. And if that's the case, then we're going to see a very San Antonio Spurs-like type of system here where everybody is always moving and always creating space for each other with player movement. And picks and screens and things like that, creating space in that way, and creating open shots in that way, that could end up being something very attractive and very beautiful to watch and very entertaining.
Right, and Lowe demonstrates that really well. In typical fashion, he includes a lot of gifts in his work, and he shows where a play worked very well to kind of support that thesis that, you know, if Miami is working on all cylinders, you're going to get a very good team, a very capable team offensively, at least. You know, he showed one particular highlight where I think Hassan Whiteside sets a high screen, and then that allows somebody to cut to the lane, and all of a sudden you have an open shot on the perimeter, and it worked to perfection. You had a lot of, you know, crisp passing. You had a good cutter, you know, going to the lane. You had Whiteside who could have rolled easily off of the screen and been open at the rim. And you have all these different factors in there, and it throws the defense off. And that's what we're hoping to see out of Miami next year. But he also, like you pointed out, you know, he mentions that there could be some spacing issues, that whether or not the guards in particular, if they're going to be hitting that shot from the perimeter, is it going to clog issues there? Is it going to be difficult to move without the ball? These are all things to take into consideration. That's where the coaching kind of takes place.
And if there's a coach to do it, you want Greg Popovich, you want Eric Spoelstra. Those are the kind of guys you want. So Steve Kerr, I mean, those are the guys you want doing that. So Spoelstra definitely will have a lot on his plate and a lot to learn and develop and teach his players and teach this team as it goes on. But let's specifically talk about that perimeter shooting. Are you worried about it? Is that something that you're actively worried about?
I am. I think about it, yeah. There are days when I'm not, and then there are days when I am.
Right.
Just because, you know, Wade isn't your typical guard at this point now, where he's not even good, he's nowhere near good from the three-point range, and Dragic isn't as lights out a shooter as you'd want. So you kind of wonder, as good as both of them are at finishing at the rim, part of that is that they're as quick as they are, that they're elusive, that they're able to get past defenders with their ball handling, and they finish at the rim so well. But you know, the other part of that is that they're just not very good at shooting from the perimeter, so that's why they've had to specialize at shooting well at the rim.
I wonder, and I think we've talked about this, about the idea of supplanting Luol Deng with Gerald Green in the starting lineup, and having Green, probably the best three-point shooter on the team, in that starting lineup to almost play that Danny Green role, where you look at the Spurs offense, Duncan's not a three-point shooter. Thiago Splitter was not a three-point shooter. Now it's going to be, I guess, Boris Diaw. Oh, no, I'm sorry, LaMarcus Aldridge, obviously. But he's not a three-point shooter. He's a mid-range shooter. Tony Parker's not a great three-point shooter. He's about as capable as Goran Dragic. And Kawhi Leonard is about as capable as Luol Deng from the corner. So, but they have that Danny Green piece, that Kyle Korver piece, that just really good three-point shooter that just opens up the floor for the other four. They're so good that they open up the floor for the other four guys on the team. They don't have that. Even Gerald Green is not that, but he's the closest thing they have to it. But a backcourt of Dragic, Wade, and Green is so bad on defense.
Right.
Well, it projects to be very bad on defense on paper. If you can get an average effort from Dragic, and you get, you know, an eager effort from Green, and he's even said that he wants to work on defense this summer. And if that proves to be the case, if Spoelstra can teach him to be a good defender, then maybe you're only worried about Wade at that point. who can get up and go on any given possession, but he just chooses not to. Maybe it's not as bad, but you're asking for a lot there.
I think the X factor here is Deng. You know, he said at the end of the season that he wasn't happy with his role in Miami, but I think he needs to kind of embrace being more of a 3-and-D type player, which is something he's not been particularly good at or skilled at throughout the course of his career.
Yeah, and again, that's another thing that's a big ask, you know? So it looks like there's a lot of, and this is like what Lowe's explaining, there's a lot of things that have to kind of break right for this team to mold. So I do worry about that in the three-point shooting in the starting lineup, but then again, you know, looking at that second unit with guys like Green, Chalmers, Tyler Johnson was a decent three-point shooter, James Ennis was a decent three-point shooter, Amar'e Stoudemire can space the floor, Chris Anderson has been working on his jump shot. There seems to be a lot more guys, Justice Winslow is also doing that, there seems to be a lot more guys that are capable perimeter shooters on that second unit than they're on that first unit. Is it just going to be a matter of just the change of pace? I mean, it's not like the Heat are going to be playing with those same five guys for 48 minutes straight. It's going to be moving around pieces here and there. We're just talking about the five guys that are starting games. There's going to be a lot of, obviously, lineup changes throughout the game. Are we worrying and talking too much about what the starting lineup's going to look like without talking as much about what it's going to look, what the different lineups might consist of?
I think it's kind of a mixed bag there because you're talking about guys that are versatile and capable, but they're not specializing in any one thing. And that's especially when it comes to perimeter shooting, you kind of almost have to specialize in that. I mean, you're talking about maybe the best in the game and guys like, you know, Korver and Danny Green, but I mean, they're very, very good at what they do. And they also provide, you know, earnest defense on occasion, and they're not bad players. They don't hurt you on the defensive end, let's say. That's true. I don't know that the guys that Miami has on their roster, I don't know if they necessarily specialize in anything. And you know, it's weird because then you're also seeing a team like the Warriors, where they have all these versatile moving parts, but how good is that team without the incredible perimeter shooting of Klay Thompson and Steph Curry?
Right.
You know, and so I think you're looking at that being the new model across the NBA of smaller lineups, guys that are more versatile, more Draymond Green types that can play a number of roles. I mean, Lowe even mentions the possibility of Luol Deng playing some power forward in some games. I guess that kind of takes away from Josh McRoberts' minutes, or Amar'e Stoudemire, I guess, playing at the power forward spot. I guess we look at that point in his career, he's more likely to play just the center position. I don't see him playing much power forward unless he has an incredibly healthy season. But even then, you're still lacking that spacing. It's going to be possibly the biggest Achilles heel for Miami this season.
It is. And on the flip side of that, we worry about that lane being clogged, because when you don't have all that spacing, you're worried about clogging the lane. And the guys that they have that are really good, Whiteside is just terrific at finishing at the rim.
Right.
You know, Wade and Dragic, obviously, in their own rights, are probably, you know, among the two best guards in the league at finishing at the rim. But they need to be at the rim to do that, so we worry about and Deng liking to cut to the... That's a big thing, too. When you don't have guys that space the floor, and you don't have those starting lineup guys that like to take jump shots as much as maybe get drive to the hoop, you do worry about all that space. And like we already talked about, when the players are moving and kind of getting to the rim at different portions of the shot clock and just moving around all this time, then it's not so, you don't worry about it so much. But you don't want this team to just be Whiteside sets the pick and roll every time they're down the court, because again, they don't have the spacers around to make that a functional thing like Dwight Howard did in Orlando with those Stan Van Gundy teams, where it's just pick and rolls and then just kick it out to the shooters. They don't have the shooters to kick it out to necessarily. So,
right.
Again, so you have these factors, but it will work if it's done right. What Lowe's hinting at, it's all these things have to be done right. Everything's got to be firing at the same cylinder. They all have to be moving at the exact right time for this to be good. But these are the kind of players that you want to do that with. Spoelstra's the kind of coach you want leading it. And the individual talent is there so much that they're still going to be a decent team, regardless if this works or not.
Yeah, and I think he hints at that also as far as the ultimate ceiling for this team. That was something we probably were going to get to a little bit later. But, you know, he talks about this team, you know, and in the context of how he breaks it down, they have a very high threshold, but at the same time, things could collapse very easily. And I guess it's hinging on, you know, this poor perimeter shooting, potential for bad defense, and the overall health of the team. And I wanted to bring up something a little bit off topic, though. You know, we haven't talked about it since we saw the picture tweeted out of Chris Bosh's kind of weight gain. You know, he noticeably looks a little bit bigger in that picture that's been making the rounds on social media, where him and a number of Heat teammates were training, I think, in California, if I'm not mistaken. What do you think is up with that? I mean, what can we make of that? And if anything, can we hint at that? That's something by design, that the coaching staff has worked with him. We know at the end of the season, he was training with the Heat staff. So if he's going to be putting on that much kind of weight, as it seems that he has, is that something that you think the coaches told him, look, we need you to go more inside now. And if that's the case, then why? Cause that would seem to hurt Miami even more with the lane clogging issues that we're already talking about.
I don't know that he is bigger. That's my thing, is I want to see an interview. I want to see him in front of a camera, live action, being bigger. I mean, I think there's a number of things at play here. It just happens that he took that picture in a gym, right? But let's say he took that picture in his living room. Like, maybe he just got fat after he was rehabbing and not playing. Maybe just not fat, but gained a little weight. I don't know. He doesn't necessarily look stronger in that picture. He just looks larger in that picture.
But it was a recent picture. This isn't post-rehab in May.
That's true. I just don't know, like, you know, cameras can do funny things, especially phone cameras. I want to see another picture. I don't know that this is confirmed, that this weight gain is confirmed. It's more just rumored based on one photo. I've looked very different, and I've looked strange in many photos. I want to see, I don't know that this is confirmed that he's bigger, and I don't know that he's going to be that big when the regular season comes along. This kind of reminds me of, oh my God, LeBron shaved his head, and that picture made the rounds for like 3 weeks, and then it just turned out that he didn't. It was just a weird photo. But I don't know. The thing is, I feel like the coaching staff has asked Bosh to do more things at the rim. And if that's the case here, then individually it makes sense for him to get bigger. As a team, you almost want him to stay quick and slim because he might be the best defender on the floor in that starting five. And when he's slim and quick and agile. And we need him to be a stretch four more now than ever with Hassan Whiteside in the lineups. But at the same time, Dan Craig recently said in an interview, I think in the Miami Herald, that Whiteside's only going to play like 22 to 25 minutes a game. You know, he might play more than that when they're going against the Andre Drummonds of the world, but he's not going to be on the floor for 36 minutes a game. So if that's the case, then you think that Whiteside will be the starter, and then as the lineups change, Bosh will shift inside to that center position that he's proven to play at a championship level, and then guys like McRoberts will get to step in, or Dang at power forward. And they'll have a little bit more of a floor spacing type of game there. So if that's the case, then maybe I would understand Bosh if he's going to get heavy dosages of minutes at center, then I understand him bulking up, but I'm still just not even convinced that he is bigger.
You know, I'm looking at other pictures on his Twitter account showing him at Dallas Cowboys training camp and playing an acoustic guitar somewhere and standing next to DeMar DeRozan. And you're absolutely right. He does not look significantly bigger in any of those pictures. I probably should have looked at that a little bit more closely. But it just made such an impression. Like, he almost looked as big as Whiteside. Which,
right. He looked huge. You know, and that's why I didn't believe it. I was like, how did this guy gain all that weight? And it didn't look real. Like, I don't know. I've just been there where I've looked very strange in pictures and people have asked. I don't know. Maybe I'm just not a good picture taker. They get my bad side. Maybe this is just one of those things. So, yeah, that's why it was the first and only evidence I saw of him. Being that large, so I thought that was just a little blown out of proportion.
I don't know if that's a new Instagram filter that makes you look all swole and 20 pounds of muscle heavier. I want that installed on my camera phone.
It's called the yoked filter.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about the team ceiling then. Lowe kind of mentions like a 47 win ceiling there for the regular season. It's not. I don't disagree with that. But I do think that this team, because of the learning curve it's going to take for these guys to play together, when this team peaks, it's going to be in the playoffs, right? Like, if we kind of just put them on that arc, and that's not bad. Like, if a 47-win team peaking in the playoffs and going to the Eastern Conference Finals is what I think this the ceiling of this team is. So I don't disagree with Lowe.
Okay.
I maybe disagree with the way he almost framed it, where it's like 47 wins and maybe do make a noise in the playoffs. But if this team just really catches its stride in the playoffs, that's what I have been expecting out of this team. I'm expecting them to start slow, is what I'm trying to say.
You really think so? I mean, they're usually so well. I mean, you look at how they started off last season, and maybe that was just because of the emotion of wanting to prove that despite LeBron's departure, that they were still a capable force, et cetera. And they got off to a pretty decent start. You know, eventually, injuries took their toll, but I mean, they've traditionally started off well. I guess, you know, with the exception of that 2010-2011 mm-hmm. season where they were still kind of gelling there.
And that's the most similar contrast we have to this one, right? It's a new team with a new, you know, new big guys that need the ball in their hands. Like, I feel like that's the most similar version of this, where you look at the different pairs, like Wade and Dragic even. They played well together last season, but just starting the season and moving forward is who's going to handle the ball a lot? Who's going to take it? And Lowe even points out they both like to go left. Like, who's going to be on that left side more? It's a weird little intricate things like that we saw between LeBron and Wade that just need to be worked out and fiddled through. How are Bosch and Whiteside going to play together? Little pairings like that. What's Dang going to do if Wade's trying to cut to the rim? Where's Dang cutting? How's he going to time his cuts now that Wade's going to be off the ball more? Little things like that.
And we never talked about it because I don't know that either of us put a lot of stock in the overall impact of the schedule, but they have a very friendly schedule to start the season. Mm-hmm. A lot of home games, that's not true. Much travel involved. And then it gets progressively worse. Like, they have a couple of stretches there later on where they're traveling quite a bit. Not only are they traveling, but they're facing very, very good teams in the process. They have a brutal schedule where they face the Clippers and then the Warriors and a couple other really great teams there. And it's just, if they're not engaged at the start of the season, if they're not on the same page, and if they're, you know, struggling a little bit with those nuances, like you pointed out, maybe 47 wins is as high as this team goes. Like, it's hard to say that, but I hadn't really considered this possibility that maybe that they would struggle to start the year because on paper they do look so talented. I mean, even SI.com just recently pointed out that all five of the starters are amongst the top 100 players in the league. I don't think any other team can boast that. So you look at the starting five there, and that's a very good team, but they all have to work very well together. Maybe it's just more of an analysis on their individual talents and not necessarily taking into consideration how they'll work together.
Right, and a lot of basketball is team basketball, but a lot of basketball is also individual one-on-one matchups. So to your point, where maybe the beginning of the schedule, they're able to rely on that individual talent, but there's going to be a point there where maybe when it gets tougher that they're going to have to rely on that team basketball. When they start getting a little bit more tread on the tires and they're not going to be able to play one-on-one basketball every single night because that exudes so much effort. There's going to be a period there where it's going to look rough, and there's going to be periods over the course of the season where it's going to look rough. But when it looks good, it's going to look great. And 47 wins, 50 wins, that ballpark is, you know, it's three wins, it's three games. So it's just like right around that ballpark. I don't know if, I'm not going to say 47 exactly is the team's ceiling, but it's like right around that ballpark feels about right to me.
So maybe it actually will wind up working better. You know, conversely, if the schedule is easier to start the year, maybe they'll have more opportunity to practice at home mm-hmm. instead of being on the road all the time where they can't get enough practices in there. And if the schedule starts off a little soft with some lesser opponents, maybe they can kind of start to really learn how to gel on the fly. And then as the season gets worse and the games become progressively harder, maybe then by that point they'll be near peak for this mm-hmm. team. And if, you know, assuming, of course, that if health holds up, then they'll start to be able to take on these more difficult challenges, the Thunders and the Warriors and the Cavaliers of the league, et cetera. So, I mean, and you also have to take in consideration they're in the Eastern Conference where presumably if they can just hover around 500, chances are they'll have a playoff spot waiting for them at the end of the season.
I'm glad you brought that up because really we know that Spoelstra has experience managing teams through the slog of the regular season so that they peak in the playoffs, right? And he's going to bring that same thing here. I mean, as long as, like you said, that they just don't suck like they did last year, and they still almost made the playoffs, for God's sakes, last year after sucking all year.
Right.
Yeah, this team is almost guaranteed to make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference, as sad as that is. But if they're focusing on those little intricate things, if they just focus on playing together as opposed to wins, we keep talking about what's this team's ceiling as far as wins, but this team's ceiling is really how they play together. This team's ceiling is looking like the Spurs on any given possession. That's the ceiling. We shouldn't even talk about wins. This team is going to win enough games just on the merit of their talent alone to make the playoffs. They just need to peak right around. They need to be gelled and playing well together and having more of those Spurs-like possessions than not in any given game when the playoffs roll around. That's what we need. That's this team's ceiling.
Yeah, I think they're arguably talented enough in the starting lineup and deep enough. Again, should health hold up, that they'll be able to challenge anybody. I don't know that there's any team as talented as the Cavaliers look. I don't know that they're necessarily overwhelmingly better than Miami, especially if they're playing at their peak.
Right. I was talking to some Cavs fans recently. Like, they worry about the Kevin Love Chris Bosh matchup. Like, that's a win for Bosh just on the defensive end. Hassan Whiteside and Timofey Mozgov. Let's just say they cancel each other out. And we have no idea what Whiteside's going to develop into this year. You know, you have Kyrie Irving, but he's a negative on defense. He's not healthy. And Goran Dragic is also an all-star point guard in his own right. Dwayne Wade is better than their shooting guard. And then you have LeBron James, obviously. And Luol Deng always plays LeBron well. And this is not me saying this. This is things that Cavs fans have brought up to me. So it's not even just being a homer or having that kind of perspective. It's those two teams match up well together.
Are they legitimately concerned? Or yes. Do they still think that Cavs... Really?
From how they framed it to me, they were.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, when it comes down to it, they have LeBron James, and that's
sure
going to be good enough to probably win that series. But I think it would definitely, you know, nothing's set in stone. Nothing's guaranteed when you have LeBron, obviously. So,
did they consider Deng not necessarily a suitable matchup, because I don't think anybody matches up well with LeBron? But I mean, do they consider him a player who might be able to at least limit LeBron somewhat or keep him from getting very, very comfortable?
Well, they did see Deng's worst when he was in Cleveland, right? Like, he just wasn't right. A good defender, things like that. They asked me about that, and Deng was better than he was in Cleveland, but still not great, still not special. And you and I have talked about this, or at least sure texted about it. Like, Deng's not as good on defense as he's you know...
He was.
Of, yeah, well, that he once was, or even is even still talked about being, you know?
Right.
You know, people around the league still consider him a very good defender, and he's just not. But he's good, and he's willing. He's probably the most willing defender that the Heat have, and that's very important. And that's what that was my answer. Is like when he gets up and goes against competition. So if he's playing against LeBron, you know that he's got a certain amount of pride that's going to help him up his game for that matchup. So, but let's talk a little bit about next season. Next season, I guess, the summer of 2016. Kevin Durant. Is it too early to start talking about that? Because it doesn't seem like it's too early for anybody else to start talking about it.
Yeah, it's unusual that it's kind of come up now. Maybe it's just because it's the dead season in the summer here and there's nothing really going on basketball related. But, you know, Lowe brought it up in his post, and then, you know, Ira Winterman also recently went on, I guess, a local radio show here in Miami and talked about that. So I guess basically the headline is that in 2016, to no one's surprise, Miami is absolutely going to be targeting Kevin Durant in free agency.
Another swing for the fence move by Riley. I mean, it shouldn't be anybody surprised. I think it's just weird that we're talking about it so soon. But at the same time, his team is constructed to make that run for him. So I guess it's worth talking about. And just kind of talking about the ceiling of this team this year, it doesn't really matter because either way, they're still built to go after Durant next summer. So if it just all goes to shit this year, they could still feasibly get Durant next year and be A-okay.
Well, Winterman in particular offered up a little nugget that I don't think anybody had previously thought about. At least you and I had never really talked about. But that if Whiteside should take a step back in his development and not become that player that we saw be historically great last season, maybe he doesn't really fit onto this roster, particularly with that league-wide kind of mandate to go smaller and smaller with your lineups, that maybe midway through the season, Whiteside could be sent to another team when his value is still reasonably high, considering that he's on such a cheap contract, but he still has all this potential. You might be able to parlay that into some future some future draft picks, or I don't think you're going to be able to get much from him in terms of overall salaried players, but you could probably get some good draft picks in the future, something that they're willing to send Miami's way to help kind of fill their coffers later on. And then that would signify, in Pat Riley's mind, a transition in overall strategy where they might want to go all in on Kevin Durant, and they don't have to worry about paying Hassan Whiteside a huge amount of money when he becomes a free agent that same summer next year.
That's a very interesting hypothetical, and even if they can't find anybody to bite during the season, if they're ready to move on from Whiteside, then maybe they don't have to re-sign him. He's not under contract. They can just let him walk and still go after Durant and pay Durant whatever he wants.
Right.
I don't know, but to me the more interesting thing is if Whiteside does pan out,
right,
and it comes down to a decision between Kevin Durant and Hassan Whiteside, I almost want to ask who would you prefer, but I also know that doesn't matter because I'm pretty sure Pat Riley would pick Kevin Durant. Right? If given the opportunity, we think that if Riley believes that he can have Durant or Whiteside, without even looking at the construction of the roster, say, that's Spoelstra's job. He'll figure it out. I'm taking Durant. That's a no-brainer, wow. Right?
That's tough, but I guess you're probably right. Just because of his attraction for the whole superstar model and the unlimited ceiling. I mean, yeah, you're right. Even Whiteside's ceiling, despite his defense and rim protection, I don't know if it is enough to minimize what Durant can produce offensively.
Right. His and all these offensive floor. Problems we've talked about, Durant completely vanquishes, right? Just null and void. All of those offensive problems we talked about. And he was the first team defender 1 or 2 years ago, 2 years ago.
When he won the MVP.
Right. And just to sweeten the pot, as if Riley needed to in that decision-making process, hypothetical, this team has won with the all-star small forward, right? The just unbelievably talented small forward. If they were to hypothetically get rid of Whiteside, they could just rerun the whole thing where they put Bosch at center. They have Durant right. at the small forward / power forward position, which he plays in Oklahoma often, and just kind of run it back with what they've proven and just with a better point guard this time. So.
Right. And you know who plays a Shane Battier role would be Justice Winslow, who they already have on the roster, And they could just start building that whole, get a couple free agency in there, a couple other veterans chasing a title, and all of a sudden you get Wade to maybe take a bit of a discount yet again, and he'd be willing to do it so he could play along with Dragic and Kevin Durant and Chris Bosh. I mean, that would be a hell of a team, right?
It would be. And it would be very, very similar to those LeBron era teams, and that could just be the model, and that could be Spoelstra's model going forward. It's just that's what he does.
And you have to think that that's certainly going to be part of Riley's pitch next summer as well. It's like, look, you come here, we've already known how to do this, we've already done it, we've already succeeded at it. You're just going to fill it in, and that's kind of a tough one there, because then part of what I've heard is that Durant, wants to kind of separate himself a little bit from LeBron James. He doesn't want to follow that same pattern. And so you don't want to tell Durant, it could go either way, right? You don't want to piss off Durant, who is a particularly sensitive person or whatever. You don't want to tell him, look, we're going to use you the same way that we use LeBron, because that could backfire. But at the same time, there's an appeal there as well in that, look, we know that if we put you into that same role LeBron held, it would work for you, you would thrive in it, and we would win a title as a result.
And I think Riley's a master negotiator and persuader and influencer, and he could do that. It's like, do you want to distance yourself from LeBron for this weird personal reason, or do you want to be considered in that same tier as LeBron, who's arguably the greatest player that's ever played the game? Do you want to put yourself in that category and just be at least in the same discussion as LeBron? Because right now you're not, because you haven't won any championships, assuming that the Thunder don't win the championship this year.
Right. And it all becomes moot if they win an OKC.
Of course. That's true, too. So, but we probably won't be in the room for that discussion, so guessing how that goes. But, I mean, that's the thing. But you're exactly right. That this is going to come down to Riley just being Pat Riley. And I actually wonder how many Heat fans would take Whiteside over Durant, because like we talked about earlier, there's that homegrown feeling about Whiteside. We found this guy. We developed this guy. And we, even when he was tackling other players, we stood by him. So, and then just to let him go for Durant would be kind of jarring, I think. I wonder how many Heat fans would be against it for that emotional reason, or just that reason of wanting to have somebody homegrown for the first time in a long time, as opposed to just going out and signing Durant.
I mean, even I hesitated a little bit when you asked the question of who would be better or who Riley would prefer, because, yeah, you know, you kind of appreciate what Whiteside brings to the table. He's, you know, eminently quotable, and and he's fun to watch. He's put up some monster games, and you want to see him swatting shots for the rest of his career with a Heat jersey, but it doesn't seem very likely. And then
I think we're going to have... because he does all those things that we were so frustrated that the Big Three era Heat didn't do, i.e. block and rebound.
Right.
He does all those things so well, and it's like those are the things that we always want to do, those big three era. So he's refreshing in that way, that he's something we haven't seen in a long time.
Now what if he just even maybe takes a little bit of a step back or isn't as consistent as he was last year, and then all of a sudden he enters free agency being kind of still of a question mark, and maybe significantly cheaper than we would imagine, and then somehow you can retain Whiteside and keep Durant and lure Durant somehow as the small forward to take over Luol Deng's spot.
Well, now I'm thinking of conspiracy theories. I'd go back to Dan Craig's quote that he's only going to play 20 to 25 minutes a game. Is that the Heat's way of keeping his numbers down? Knowing that maybe this team doesn't really have a ceiling of winning the title this year.
So, well, I think his numbers are going to go down regardless, right? When you have as loaded a starting lineup as they do.
They can use that into the negotiating process, but
everybody's
numbers. Yeah, we already know that the Heat don't want to pay him the max. We know that already. They've already stated that, so at least in reports that we've read. So, yeah, we know that that's a goal of theirs, and everybody says that they can't sign Whiteside and Wade and Durant, but if Wade takes a lot less, and that figure is based on another $20 million contract for Wade, but we don't know that that's what Wade's going to ask for. We don't know if there's a, you know, behind closed doors deal where Wade gets $20 million this year and takes like $10 million next year, right, averaging out to $15 million a year. We don't know that that's not going to happen, and if you tell Wade, we can get Durant, all we need for you to do is sacrifice somewhere between $5 and $10 million this year, and you know we'll take care of you at some point.
Do you
Wade, I think, does that based on his history, right? Like, Wade takes that pay cut to go win more championships and win another championship without LeBron again,
right?
Because we know that that's a competitive thing.
Sure, and he can prove to be the anti-Kobe, and that, you know, he ages much better, and that he's able to, you know, accommodate a new team that's willing to you know, take over the load, so to speak, and he can still be, you know, incredibly productive even at this point in his career. So, I mean, it's all hypotheticals, but at the same time, it certainly seems to fit the model of what we've seen from Wade.
You'll always be that anti-Kobe if you're on a winning team. Because right now, the reason Kobe's not a great player right now is because he's on a bad team. But if you surround him with great talent like LeBron and Durant and those guys, we still think of Durant in that upper, you know, 40. He'd make the top 50 of SI's list, right? Like, if he were on one of those teams, I would think. Because he would be on great teams. And that always just changes the way you view a player. And I think that's almost, if Wade is always just playing on really good competitive teams and adapting his game to those guys, then he'll always be revered in that upper tier of players.
I agree. A lot to consider there. I mean, I know that's jumping ahead and kind of taking away from the overall theme of what we were going to talk about as far as what this season represents, but it's always interesting to kind of, you know, go a little bit into the future and project what could possibly happen with the Heat.
But that does really have to do with this season, because these players are on short contracts. It's just it's that cloud that's looming, right? It's like, there's always going to be that Kevin Durant chase kind of overhead, intertwined between the lines of this season. There's going to be something there, right? Like, the Kevin Durant's impending free agency is just between the lines of this entire NBA season, regardless, just outside of the Heat. It's just something that every team is paying attention to.
Yeah, sounds like an overall great post waiting to be written.
Wow, who's gonna read it? Who's gonna write it? Everybody will read it. All right. Well, is anything else that stuck out from Zach Lowe's post that you wanted to comment on, or did we touch on everything?
I think we pretty much hit on all the major points. Again, you know, go check it out if you can. Criticize him for using the heat check in the headline, yep. But do definitely check it out because it's very informative, very interesting, and if you haven't done so already, definitely do so.
Speaking of heat checks, you can find the original heat check on iTunes and subscribe there. Thanks to the people that are reviewing us. I was on there yesterday and saw that we have a lot more reviews. So to all the listeners out there doing that, thank you very much. We really appreciate it. Check us out on SoundCloud, on Stitcher Radio. We're on there too. I forgot to mention that last time. And then, of course, on the Hardwood Paroxysm Network. Go to hardwoodparoxysm.com. Go to audioboom.com/hardwoodparoxysm. And you will find our podcast among many other fantastically great podcasts about fantasy basketball, about the NBA at large, about all different kinds of things, advanced stats, everything that you'd ever want to listen to about the NBA you can find there. So we're happy to be part of that team. And find the writing at allyoucanheat.com, and you'll see the podcast there too. So thanks for listening, and thanks for joining me, Dave.
You got it, Wes.